Welcome. This is actually the second incarnation of the speech. It was beta tested at a prior con, so this is the finished, finalized version of it. Welcome to Monumental Women in the Technology of Today. I am the one they call Leap Freak. This presentation has been in the making for approximately 3.5 years now and was aided in research by a little over a dozen of my friends. And only being fair, being a woman myself and in being involved in technology, that I should start by giving you a little background about myself before we start. I am a recent graduate, May 2008, of Pennsylvania College of Technology. During my 4 years, I completed 6 different degree programs. They are listed on the slide. I do hold several certifications in addition to that, A+ and N+. And for the last 4 years, I've been a member of good standing as well as an officer of the ACM and IEEE of my college. In 2002, I founded my own consulting firm and have been working for myself since. I have since absorbed another company and have one employee beneath me. A lot of these women face the same hardships that also affected me from the first day I got to college and the first day I set foot in the classroom where I thought it was professionals, gender bias. ENIAC was surrounded by issues of sexual tension in the workplace. It was unusually high at that time for men, and unusually hard at that time for men and women to work in the same laboratory or even in the same room. And these women were supposed to be respected on the same level as their male coworkers. For example, Jean Bartik was almost fired by the director after the Moore School found out she got married. They felt that as soon as she became pregnant, she'd quit. After the first successful demonstration of ENIAC in 1946, the male staff decided they were going to have champagne to celebrate, popped the corks and said, "Okay, women, time to go home." The original 6 women of ENIAC, 2 remained after they married. During that time, it was difficult for women to both have a career and have children. So their colleagues really looked down on them as being less important, less intelligent, just less of a person, because they were married, they had kids. As you look into history, the treatment of female contributions to the sciences, there's a lack of female role models for the new younger generations. I was informed earlier in this conference, I consider myself at 22 no longer young, because I can remember certain things that the young of today don't. To put in perspective, my mother at my age had a full paid scholarship to Dickinson Law School. She really wanted to be a lawyer. She had a brother 2 years older than her who really wanted to go into the sciences. So my grandparents gave all the money that they had saved up for her to him to go to college. He used his degree for 2 years, quit, got married, and then lives off his stock interest. My mother just retired after 37 years of teaching and used every cent of her degree that she had to pay for herself because the woman was going to use it 2 years, get married, and quit. These she-geeks shaped the face of modern computing. And because I mentioned ENIACs in my example and gender bias, let's start by looking at that. My slide shows. This picture is courtesy of the U.S. Army Photographic Archives. The IEEE captioned it a certain way. I thought it was really kind of interesting. So few people knew that the women participated in the development of early computers that they were often photographed in obviously posed shots, like this one of the ENIAC programmers. Images such as this visually demonstrated the contrast between people's conception of computer hardware, which was usually associated with men, with the reality that women lived and involved in its creation and use. ENIAC stands for the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer, and originally programmed by a group of 6 women. The women working in the field until this time could only be described as a men-only area. It was codenamed Project PX and was constructed by the University of Pennsylvania's Moore School of Engineering. It was massive by today's standards. Today's computers fit on your desk, in your purse, your pocket, just about anywhere. ENIAC was massive. Just to give you an example, I have the specs for it. 17,468 vacuum tubes, 7,200 crystal diodes, 1,500 relays, 70,000 resistors, 10,000 capacitors, and 5 million hand-soldered joints. Weighed 27 tons, was 8.5 feet by 3 feet by 80 feet, and consumed 150 kilowatts of power per hour. Input was done by an IBM card reader with an IBM punch card for output. It's very big. Assembly of the behemoth began in 1943, was completed Valentine's Day 1946 for a cost of $50,000. Now, I thought $50,000 for that time, not a lot of money. I checked with the Department of Labor and Statistics. According to inflation and all the fun stuff, that's $5,554,666.67 of today's money, little over $5.5 million. I'm going to kill this slideshow. My laptop has eaten my slideshow 3 times so far. Women were selected to work with ENIAC because they were regarded as being capable of doing their work faster and more accurately than their male counterparts. At one point, the employee list of the Moore School consisted of 80 women and 3 men. Talk about a work ratio. Initially, women weren't allowed in the same room with ENIAC because, of course, it was for military purposes, and they had to stand behind a glass partition with all of the instruction manuals and diagrams and everything else. They were forced to stay there and learn it themselves. When they were finally allowed in the same room with the unit, most of their time was spent, guess this, cleaning up after the male engineers. The women who worked in the Moore School chose to forego a traditionally female career choice, like teaching or nursing, to pursue mathematics. At that time, it was generally accepted careers for college education were teaching or nursing for women. If they didn't choose that, they were expected to marry and reproduce. That was the sole purpose for them. These women wanted to apply their knowledge. They wanted to be more, so they went to the field of mathematics. Programming then was nothing like it is today. It was laboring, changing connections, inputting immense amounts of data via punch cards, cabinets and cabinets and cabinets of punch cards. These women understood the intricacies of the design because they did extensive self-training where the men sat down in the classroom and had someone spoon-feed it to them. It was integral to the success of the demonstration of ENIAC in 1946. Starting from that demonstration, it ran continually until October 2, 1955, and through its uptime, it was only shut down once to expand the memory and to move it to a new location. But before ENIAC, there were predecessors whose advances helped make this possible. Some influential women. Her birth name was Augusta Ada Byron. She was the first legitimate child of poet Lord Byron. Her full name and title for most of her married life, as you see it on the slide, the Right and Honorable Augusta Ada, Countess of Lovelace. She was educated both socially and culturally because of her affiliation with the Blue Stockings, a society who emphasized education and discussion of literature in cooperation with educated men who had to be invited to participate. She is known for having written vivid descriptions of Charles Babbage's early mechanical general-purpose computer, the analytical engine. Charles Babbage was an English professor of an English-British professor of mathematics, philosopher, inventor, and mechanical engineer. Oddly enough, he was illiterate. This is why she had to write all of his notes. It was first described in 1837, but Babbage continued to work on the design until his death in 1871. Of course, due to financial, political, and legal issues, it was never actually built. Some believe that the technical limitations at the time hindered the construction, but the theory anticipated the first completed general-purpose computer in about 100 years. The uncompleted mechanisms are currently on display at the London Museum of Science. However, in 1991, they did something interesting. They built a perfectly functioning difference engine based on the original descriptions she wrote, and it worked. Babbage also designed a printer for the analytical engine that was assembled in the year 2000, and they concluded that an astonishingly complex device in the 19th century, it too would have worked. She enclosed a set of notes with the article that specified in complete detail a method for calculating Bernoulli's numbers using the analytical engine. This is recognized by historians as the world's first computer program. For her work, Babbage gave her the title the Enchantress of Numbers. She also noted some possibilities of the machine which Babbage never published. She hypothesized in her notes that the engine might one day compose elaborate and scientific pieces of music of any degree of complexity or extent. Babbage himself only really focused on calculating numbers, number crunching, and things that would better the men of society. She thought outside of the box. Unfortunately, she died at the age of 36. Her physician at that time used bloodletting to try and cure uterine cancer, and she bled out and died. She left behind 2 sons and a daughter and was buried next to her father, whom she really never knew. The computer language Ada was created by the U.S. Defense Department and named after her. The military standard associated with it, MILSTD-1815, was given the number of the year of her birth. For a bit of trivia, her portrait can be seen on Microsoft product authenticity holograms for products prior to Windows 98. And since 1998, the British Computer Society has awarded a medal in her name. And on June 16th, On June 16th, 2008, the Undergraduate Lovelace Colloquium was held at the University of Leeds, which has become an annual competition for women students of computer science that's sponsored by the likes of Google, Shell, Mobile, and IBM. Thank you. Frances Elizabeth Snyder, who after marriage changed her name to Betty Holberton, was the granddaughter of an astronomer and grew up loving classical literature and language. She was left-handed, cross-eyed, and constantly harassed by her classmates even into college. When she began to study math at the University of Pennsylvania, her math professor said she should be staying home raising children instead of wasting her time to achieve a degree and survive in a man's world. She decided she would study journalism because it was one of the few programs of study that was open to women in her time. It allowed her to travel, she got to see the world, and she got to do things that she enjoyed. Because of her journalism background, she was hired by the Moore School as a computer. This led her to being chosen as one of the six women who programmed ENIAC. Although they were classified as sub-professionals, they programmed it to perform calculations for ballistics trajectories. After World War II, she worked at Remington Rand and the National Bureau of Standards. She was the chief of the programming research branch of Applied Mathematics Laboratory at the David Taylor Model Basin in 1959. Betty believed that computers would only prosper if they were easy to program and operate. But her most memorable quote from her many notes was saying that she spent half of her time trying to figure out what people needed in a computer, and the other half convincing a male engineer it was his idea so it would get done. She led the committee that developed the standards for COBOL and Fortran languages, and worked in conjunction with Grace Hopper. She invented the mnemonic instruction set called C10 and the binary binary automatic computer, BINAC, which Grace Hopper later called the basis for all subsequent programming languages in existence. She influenced the design of portions of hardware for UNIVAC, as well as much of the software. She was the one who decided they should color it gray instead of black to conserve heat. The software she designed for UNIVAC was delivered to the U.S. Census Bureau in March of 1951, which was then used to process the 1950 census results. She was responsible for the first sort and merge generator for UNIVAC 1, which led to the way for Hopper's compilers. In 1997, she received the Augusta Ada Lovelace Award and was inducted into the Women in Technology International Hall of Fame, along with other female ENIAC programmers. Rear Admiral Grace Murray Hopper, whom the room next door is named for, was born Grace Brewster Murray in New York City. Because of her naval rank and being one of very few women to make it to Rear Admiral, she was referred to as Amazing Grace. She was the third programmer of the Harvard Mark I calculator. I say third because the first two were male. She made her the first female programmer. She developed the first compiler for computer programming language, COBOL, with the aid of a committee of programmers that worked with her. In 1928, she graduated from Vassar College with a BA in mathematics and physics and joined their faculty while she continued math studies at Yale, where she earned a master's in 1930 and a PhD in 1934. She was one of four women in her doctoral program out of a total of 10 students. It was considered very rare for women at that time to complete an entire doctorate program. She was determined to join the military as soon as the world entered World War II, though she never served in naval combat because at the age of 34, she was told she was too old and not heavy enough for her height to enlist. However, they said that her job as a mathematics professor was considered essential to the war effort, and thus she was to remain teaching at Vassar College. The Harvard Mark I was the first large-scale automatic digital computer in the U.S. According to the IBM archive, Mark I had a steel frame of 51 feet long, 8 feet high, that held the calculator, which consisted of an interlocking panel of small gears, counters, switches, and control circuits, a few inches in depth that used 500 miles of wire, 3 million connections, 3,500 multipole relays, 35,000 contacts, 2,225 counters, 1,464 10-pole switches, and tiers of 72 adding machines, each with 23 significant numbers. It was fully automatic, meaning it did not need any human intervention once it was started. The unit was fed by a 24-channel punched paper tape, which would then process and read in the next one. At this point in technology, there was no such thing as a conditional branch instruction, so any complex program was physically humongous. This problem brought about the term loop, which comes from the fact that the operators would literally join both ends of the tape together So the program would continue to feed back in automatically and no one had to sit and babysit it. The term bug, in reference to computers, is also attributed to Grace, stemming from a story of one of her associates finding a moth stuck in a relay. When the other associate asked what they were doing, she answered, "Debugging the system." The remains of the moth, in the little picture, can be found in the group's logbook, which is currently on display at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. As the log reads, since it's a little tiny on the screen, 1100 hours started cosine tape sign check, 1525 started multi-adder test, 1545 relay number 70 panel F, moth found in relay, first actual case of bug being found in computer. After her retirement from the Navy on August 14th, which was 1986, which was involuntary at the time, because once you turn 80, you have to retire, she was awarded the Defense Distinguished Service Medal during a celebration aboard the USS Constitution. At that moment, she was the oldest officer in the Navy aboard the oldest ship in the Navy. She was hired as a senior consultant to Digital Equipment Corporation and remained an employee there until her death at 85. Her position at DEC involved working as a goodwill ambassador, lecturing on the early days of computers, her career, and her efforts, so that computer vendors could make life easier for their users. An administration building on the Naval Support Activity of Annapolis, previously known as the Naval Station Annapolis, is named the Grace Hopper Building in her honor. In addition, I had a legal professor who had an office four doors down from her in the same building during her time in the Navy, who told interesting stories about her thinking outside of the box. Her most famous quotation that he could give me was, "It's easier to ask for forgiveness than to get permission. A ship in the harbor is safe, but that's not what ships are built for." I think I like her already. Jean Samet was born March 23, 1928, also in New York City. She received her bachelor's from Mount Holyoke College and her master's from the University of Illinois, both in mathematics. In 1955, she became employed by Sperry Gyroscopes on Long Island and supervised their scientific programming group, which is at that time all male employees. From 1955 to 1958, she was the first group leader for programmers at Sperry Gyroscope. During her time there, she taught what were considered the first earliest computer courses given for academic credit. She organized and taught two graduate courses entitled the Digital Computer Programming and Digital Advanced Computer Programming in the Graduate of Applied Mathematics Department at Adelphi College on Long Island. She taught them using UNIVAC and the 704, and by the end of the second year used Fortran, which had then just been released. From 1958 to 1961, she worked for Sylvania Electric Products, where she managed the Moby Dick project. She served as the key member for the committee that developed COBOL. Moby Dick, the mobile digital computer, was a computer built for the Army Signal Corps to computerize the distribution of intelligence around the battlefield, a 6-bit code known as field data. The unit was so large, it was housed in two tractor trailer units that demanded the reliability of two base machines of an era that couldn't provide it. One tractor trailer housed only the IBM 533 card reader and card punch. The other trailer contained everything else. For a strange random fact, there were four incarnations of Moby Dick. The last was built off a lobby of one of Sylvania Needham, Massachusetts buildings that ran until 1965. Since it was derived from Moby Dick, but was unable to move, the male engineer group christened it Rigid Dick. In 1961, she organized and managed the IBM Boston Advanced Programming Department in Cambridge, where she initiated concept and directed the development of FORMAC. FORMAC, the Formula Manipulation Compiler, was the first widely used language designed specifically for doing symbolic math. In 1969, she authored Programming Languages, History and Fundamentals, which was deemed instant computer text classic. In 1979, she became software technology manager in the Federal Systems Division of IBM, where she led the work for the Ada programming language. She held positions with and received numerous honors and awards from the ACM, the HOPL. She established the Journal of Annals of Computer History Consulting. She was elected to the National Academy of Engineering in 1977 and received an honorary Doctor of Science from Mount Holyoke College in 1978. Barbara Liskov, born Barbara Hobron in 1939, in 1968, she became the first woman in the U.S. to be awarded a PhD from Stanford University from the Computer Science Department. She is currently an MIT faculty member. I had the pleasure of emailing her some questions for this speech and received a prompt response within the first week. She designed CLU, the first programming language to support data abstractions. CLU is said to be the closest language to being full object-oriented programming without actually being one. It was based on Algol, but was designed to avoid problems from Fortran. It gave rise to Pascal. Algol uses bracketed statement blocks, and was the first to use a begin and end pair for delimitation. On a humoring note, Clue is the name of Kevin Flynn's program avatar on Tron. Little bit of history. Python and Ruby borrowed their concepts from CLU, and among them were the yield statements and multiple assignments. CLU and Ada were major inspirations for C++ templates and exception handling mechanisms that influenced Java. In 2004, she won the John Van Neumann Medal for fundamental contributions to programming languages, programming methodology, and distributed systems. To date, she's authored 3 books and more than 100 technical papers. Edith Clark was born February 10, 1883, in Ellicott City, Maryland. She had 8 siblings, and by the age of 12, both of her parents had died, leaving her a significant fortune to inherit at 18. She died October 29, 1959. She studied mathematics and astronomy at Vassar College. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa in 1908. She was enrolled at the University of Wisconsin Civil Engineering Program in 1911. Her summer job was working as a mathematical computing assistant at AT&T, which turned into her full-time job. Her first assignment was to calculate the first 7 terms of an infinite series that represented a probability function. She became the manager of a group of women who made calculations for the Transmission and Protection Engineering Department during World War I. She also studied radio at Hunter College and electrical engineering at Columbia University. She left AT&T in 1918 and studied electrical engineering at MIT in Boston, where she earned her master's in 1919. This was the first electrical engineering degree ever awarded to a woman at MIT. Her master's thesis was entitled Behavior of a Lumpy Artificial Transmission Line as the Frequency is Indefinitely Increased. In 1926, she became the first woman to present a paper before the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, the AIEE. Between 1923 and 1945, she published 18 technical papers. One paper which she co-authored was published in 1941 and received the National First Paper Prize of the Year Award. After graduating, she spent 26 years working at General Electric, where she retired in 1945. The central theme in her engineering career was the development and dissemination of mathematical methods that served to simplify and reduce the time spent doing laborious calculations in solving problems in the design and operation of large electrical power systems. She became the authority on the manipulation of hyperbolic functions and equivalent circuits and graphical analysis. Her paper entitled The Steady State Stability in Transmission Systems described a mathematical technique to model a power system and its behavior that allowed engineers to analyze the longer transmission lines and were becoming more common among growing telephone industries. It was the first public mathematical examination of transmission line over 300 miles in length, and was the first published use of the network analyzer to obtain data. In 1947, she was appointed a full professor at the University of Texas, becoming the first female professor of electrical engineering in the country. She continued to teach there until 1956. In 1948, she became the first woman elected as a fellow of the American Institute of Electrical Engineers. In 1954, she received the Society of Women Engineers Achievement Award, and the official IEEE award read, in recognition of her many contributions to stability theories and circuit analysis. Which brings me to my next part of the presentation, the women of the phone. How many guys in the room think that'd be a great title for geek porn? Hedwig Eva Maria Kiesler, Hedy Lamarr, was born November 9, 1913 in Vienna, and died January 19, 2000 in Elmont Springs, Florida. Upon her wishes, her body was cremated, and her son transported the urn to Vienna and spread them among the Vienna wood, the German Wienerwald, in the Alps. She was raised studying ballet and piano. She was said to have possessed the perfect combination of exotic glamour and sex appeal that was labeled the most beautiful woman in the movie world. Her first husband, a Vienna arms manufacturer of 13 years her senior, was an Austrian fascist and objected to her acting career. He instead took her to meetings with military technicians and business partners where she learned about military technologies. In 1937, she ran away from her husband and moved to Paris, where she met Louis B. Mayer in London, and he convinced her to change her name to pay homage to Barbara Lamar, a famously beautiful film star of the silent era. Once in Hollywood, she was cast as a glamorous and seductive, and once cast as the likes of Lana Turner and Judy Garland in the musical Ziegfeld Girl. She has a star on the Walk of Fame. In 1933, she starred in Ecstasy, where she played a love-hungry young wife of an indifferent old husband. During her role, they showed many close-ups of her face in a state of orgasm, long shots of her running nude through the woods, which gave the film its notoriety. Strangely, the expressions on her face during the film were not a direct result. They were the result of the director poking her in the ass with a safety pin. She co-invented an early form of spread spectrum, which is the precursor to modern wireless communications. Together with George Antheil, the avant-garde composer and neighbor of Lamar, they experimented with automated control of instruments and submitted the idea to a secret communication system in June 1941. On August 11, 1942, it received U.S. patent number 2292387. This early version of frequency hopping used a piano roll to change between 88 different frequencies and was intended to make radio-guided torpedoes harder for an enemy to detect or jam. Although the idea was slightly impractical, very ahead of its time, and infeasible due to the state of mechanical technology in 1942, it was not implemented until 1962, when it was used by U.S. military ships during a blockade of Cuba after the patent had expired. Neither Antheil nor Lamar made any money from this invention, mostly due to a lag in development. In 1997, the EFF gave her an award for her contribution. This frequency hopping idea became the basis for modern spread spectrum communications technologies used in devices from cordless phones to Wi-Fi to CDMA. She wanted to join the National Inventors Council, but was told she would be better off helping the war effort using her celebrity status to sell war bonds. At her first event, she raised $7 million. In 1998, a vector diagram of her face was used by Corel on the package of Corel Draw 8. Her family's attorney sued Corel for the damages, unrelated to authorized use of her likeness, which was settled out of court for an undisclosed sum in 1999, terms that allowed Corel 5 years exclusive rights to her image. In 2003, Boeing ran a series of ads featuring her as the woman of science, but no reference to her film career was ever made. In 2005, the first Inventors' Day of German-speaking countries was held in her honor, November 9th, which would have been her 92nd birthday. My favorite quote from her film career is, "Films have a certain place in certain time periods. Technology is forever." How many people can tell me what the woman in the picture is doing? Here's a hint. This picture is courtesy of the AT&T archives. This is an operator delivering the time live to callers in the 1920s when the call-in service started. They were paid 45 cents an hour to sit in a booth for 6-hour shifts and read the time every 15 seconds. According to AT&T's archives, the time, as they called it, began in Chicago in 1928, where two operators would sit in front of clocks and read the time every 15 seconds to anyone who called. People who were selected to work took their jobs very seriously and were called the timekeepers. The telephone companies at that time declared it cutting-edge service. Sometime in the 1940s, it became automated, recorded onto tape, played as needed. These time machines, as they were called, were large drums 2 feet in diameter with as many as 100 album-like audio tracks on the exterior. Whenever someone called, the drums would turn, the message would begin playing, mixed with different tracks on the fly. In the state of California, prefixes for calling time was 767 and 853. No matter what 4 digits you dialed after that, you would get the time of day information service. So Northern California instituted an advertising campaign to help callers remember. To get the time of day, dial popcorn. For decades, people dialed it for resetting VCRs and changing their watches after daylight savings time. The last two remaining states that utilized it were California and Nevada. Currently, California was in need of new telephone numbers, so they're discontinuing the service. They're recycling the numbers as a necessity. I feel bad for people who get anything in those prefixes. Their phone is going to ring off the hook. As of September 19, 2007, the service has been discontinued and the bank of numbers will be recycled starting October 2008. Many of the time ladies and a few of the time gentlemen, as they were called, came and went over the years. In 1950, a woman named Mary Moore emerged as the nation's leading time teller. She read hours, minutes, and seconds in a distinctive, and some say prissy tone, with odd pronunciations. She was succeeded by Jane Barbie. As far as I know, the service is still in use for the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington and at the original recording facility in Atlanta. The last number available for Eastern Standard Time as of January 14th, 2008 is 770-455-7141. However, when I tried to verify the number, it was a recording promoting the religious Save the Children donation service. According to the Time and Frequency Division of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the only two telephone numbers available are for Colorado and Hawaii. There is no toll-free number. Jane Barbie was born July 29, 1928 in Florida. She was an American voice actress. She was a professional singer where she met her husband while touring with the Buddy Morrow Orchestra. She was the featured singer and John was the road manager, the musical director, and a band member. Their initial business venture was producing music for commercials and industrial films. She died July 18, 2003 in Roswell, Georgia from complications of cancer. Jane received a Bachelor of Fine Arts at the University of Georgia for her study of drama, where she stood as president of Delta 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 Sorority and an active member of several volunteerism groups. Post-graduation, she worked as a copywriter. However, she had horrible spelling. She read her first commercial to her boss instead of submitting it in writing, and he loved it so much, he made her record the commercial herself. In 1963, she began doing recorded messages for the Autocron company that announced the time, temperature, and weather. It's better known as the Electronic Telecommunications Inc., or ETC. She also has done recordings for early voicemail systems and for personalized announcements for financial institutions. She is the voice of my AT&T voicemail system. If you call on your cell phone, you will get her. Her recordings were used in Hong Kong, Saudi Arabia, and various other countries. Her birth dialect was Southern, but while studying drama, she adopted the General American Speech, also known as Standard Spoken American English or American Broadcast English. She used that for most of her work. General American is also sometimes called Standard Midwestern, Standard Spoken English, or American English. It is the most neutral and free of regional characteristics. When she was asked to record time temperature messages for Australian Communications Corporation, she perfected an Australian accent by listening to recordings of Australian speakers. She founded the Atlanta branch of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. She also performed voiceover work on various TV shows and films. How many of you have seen The Making of a Legend, Gone with the Wind? I can't see hands from up here. She was the voice of the Southern author Margaret Mitchell. It is estimated that as of today, her voice has been heard by over 20 million people around the world. She was succeeded by Pat Fleet. Pat Fleet is an American voice actress who succeeded Jane Barbie for the voice of AT&T. She provides the voiceover for the company audio logo and is played prior to any operator-assisted or credit card-paid call, as well as during radio and television commercials. She began working alongside Jane Barbie in 1981, recording messages for the Autocron company and the voice of Bell System automated coin toll system. She's currently the voice of the caller intercept, giving her the nickname the We're Sorry Lady. AT&T performed internal customer studies and determined that their customers preferred her voice over anyone else's, and as a result, she was selected to be the company's signature voice. I could go into much further detail about the systems, the women, the intricacies, but due to time, the fact I'd like to take some questions or comments, I'll stop here. I'll give you a short clip, available on YouTube if you'd like to view it later, from an episode of Nightline with interviews of Jane Barbie and Pat Fleet.
Two of the megastars of voicemail.
The information you desire, and
if you're calling from a
touch tone,
name or extension number,
order
AM to 530.
Thank you for calling.
This is the customer originated trace feature. A $5 charge will be added to your telephone.
That is a familiar voice. I mean, you've heard that voice before, right? Actually, that voice is heard
this was done
every
in 1982,
day, several
by the
times
way.
A day
it looks old.
By millions of Americans.
I'm Pat Fleet. I'm the voice you most often hear when you make a long-distance telephone call. AT&T. AT&T. Thank you for using AT&T. I also do other intercept messages when you dial a wrong telephone number or dial a number that's been disconnected or you need to deposit 25 cents before making your call. That's me.
That has been the signature voice of AT&T for over 5 years now. And for the last 13 years of her professional voiceover career, she has been recording at the same studio in Atlanta, Georgia, where you might hear another familiar voice.
I'm Jane Barbie, and I talk to about 50 million people every day. Many times I might tell them something like, at the tone, the time will be 7:45, temperature 80.
Good morning. This is your wake-up call.
We do automated hotel wake-up calls. Nobody likes to get those. We all want to stay in our beds and snuggle, but it's a necessary evil. We try to be as gentle with them as we possibly can.
It produces, as you might imagine, a certain sort of fame.
7:45.
People that know that this is what I do will come up to me and say, say it, say it. Let me hear you say it.
Oh, say it, say it, say it, you know. So here you are at a cocktail party and you feel like a perfect idiot.
And then when you do, they go, oh my God.
It really is you. I talk to you all the time.
It's logical in an illogical sort of way. Think of them as the two women who personify the depersonalized message.
At this point, I'd like to take any questions, comments, or concerns that you may have. Anyone?
Question?
Oh, I don't know. Favorite of the computer era, favorite of the women of the phone?
Computer.
I don't know. Personally, I like Ada because she started out with this controlling husband and ended up running off and doing her own thing, and she's so far thinking outside of the box. The box is gone in the horizon.
There was an excellent book published a few years ago called Unlocking the Clubhouse. It was a study that was done in Carnegie Mellon University about women trying to enter the computer science field there and the challenges
No, I had heard of it, but I had not gotten a copy of it yet. Every time I've gone to Barnes & Noble, they keep telling me they'll order it for me. Yeah. Now, I can't see hands with the lights. I think there's... No, that's okay. I see you. Yeah.
So throughout all your research over the years, have you come up with any theory or idea of why women are still so tragically underrepresented in computer science and basically IT in general?
I'm thinking the more we get, I say civilized, the more women I'm seeing in technology. When I started college in 2004, there were 4 women in the IT department of 1,200 students. When I graduated in May, there was 22. It's not that many of an increase, but it's to me a significant number that we could change their mind to go from a traditionally female career into something that if they're truly interested, they can feel free to explore without persecution. I think that a lot of the previous younger generations were still subject to the older grandparent age where women had to do certain things, and that as the older generation dies off, the ideas of the newer generation will no longer be hindered by them. I see a waving hand. What an ass. I'm so proud. I know how you feel when I started college.
You talk about why are women not in engineering?
That's the reason. When I started college, I walked into an IT help desk course where the professor was a Unix reject from Pixar Studios who had never seen Windows in his life and was teaching Windows help desk. I was the only woman in his class. He got to roll call, got down to my name, looked at me and said, "Must be you." After the second semester, I had to take him for the second part of the class, the level 2. He was so frustrated that I had turned him in for the off comment while I was in the ladies' room. He thought I couldn't hear me, of saying women don't belong in technology, that they told him very politely, either you quit quietly or we fire you. I was proud of myself. I didn't appreciate his comment.
Three parts of this topic, so I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
One, a lot of the women during early times of computers all were mathematicians or
right.
had a physics background. Do you personally think that, I've thought this is as well, but or do you personally believe that this idea that I have is valid?
Okay.
That maybe most women would get into mathematics also because academically they could excel and publish papers while going underneath the pseudonyms and not using their actual full name by, you know.
Actually, I'll answer it this way. I read a lot of genetic studies, my mother being a retired bio teacher, and there was a study that was published about 7 or 8 years ago that they did a genetic study of the difference between males and females, and they determined that women were more analytical and they could determine things like mathematics and science on a level that males could not, that males were better at hands-on things. So women were technically more suited to be mathematicians or scientists or teachers because they were very detail-oriented. I think as time goes on, despite that being said, that perhaps more so they could get into other fields. At the time, to answer your why that was all mathematics, that was one of the very few fields women were allowed to be in. Some colleges had a restriction when you applied as to what majors women were allowed to be in and which ones they were not. So sometimes they didn't get a choice.
The second part of the question is, I have to say, I'm proud to say that my mom was the first recipient of the International Science Fair Award. And
bravo.
First female recipient of the International Science Fair Award.
Nice.
And she tells it to me all the time because she has the award and how she wasn't a great student in class because she had a lot of developmental problems and family issues. But her project was on the genetic mutation of fruit flies after the bombardment from radioactivity. And she did the whole Mendel tree and stuff like that and showed how different genetics and even still...
Did she publish a paper on that?
Actually, the Science Fair Award and her research and notes were used as a basis for other effects of radiation. Look at that from then on.
I've read that study.
And this is like back from like the 50s. As well.
Yeah.
My mom used to have her mom drive her to Notre Dame University in Indiana to use their labs to do her stuff on both tomatoes and the fruit flies.
They use that in biotech books now.
Yeah. And
I am honored to meet you.
Well, my mom's the one who did it. And the one thing, though, is she basically, along the way, they at first were not going to let her go to San Francisco to do compete in the final one.
That's wrong.
Because she was female, and they thought that this boy who was going to be a salute Victorian would be better suited to go because my mom was just a D student in her science classes.
That sucks.
But, yeah, I have to say, I think everyone here has got to say, Hedy?
Yeah.
Hey, Lamar. Awesome.
There is a certain aspect of using the younger pictures of the women. Yeah. I see a hand flying in the back. Hi.
So it's 2008. Folks here are part of companies. How do we attract women to our companies? What do you suggest we do to make
I'm really not the best person to answer that because I'm unemployed. I've applied to, and I kid you not, I have every rejection letter, 172 different companies since February of this year. I have had 61 interviews. I have 4 second return interviews. And every one of those interviews turned into, yeah, you're qualified, but we hired internally. Or a lesser qualified male candidate that was an internal candidate. I think it would be nice if they looked at us on a stasis of a person as opposed to whether we have boobs or not, or on the stasis of whether we have a quota to fill of diversity quota. I'm a person just like you. When I'm in a job interview, if you have a pretend I'm a guy. If that makes you feel more comfortable, don't look at the name at the top of the resume, just pretend I'm a male candidate. If anybody's interested in hiring me, I will take business cards and send you a resume after the end of this conference. Anybody else? Ooh, front.
I was just reading yesterday, I guess, that they're talking about extending the Title IX to women in the science and engineering fields.
Just saw that one, too.
Everything that happens when you basically apply affirmative action to women in science and engineering. It's the same thing. So what do you think about that?
It turns into a nasty conflict, and I'd like to see what they're going to do with it. I'd like to see something nice come out of it with not very much argument, but I do have to read more into that. Yeah, I know. It's going to turn into years and years and years of argument, which is what I'm afraid of, and then it's going to get to the point where they go, eh, let's table it for a while. So, I'm hoping it ends pretty. One more.
Have you come across any organizations that you find are taking positive steps about getting more women into IT and science and engineering?
The ACM has a division for the Women in Technology. They do a monthly newsletter and mailing, and they hold a conference every year, and I've been to the last two of them, and I think it's fantastic that there's a group, and there is more than one, but this is the only one I've had personal experience with, that will sit down and the entire conference is women and companies that look for hiring women and companies that need to sit down and go through a level of sensitivity training where they need to know how to hire women or how to deal with women in their workplace. Anybody else? I'm blinded by the light. I'll come back. You.
What do you think this is going to be behind us, like 10 years, 20 years?
It depends on how fast people can let go of their old ideology and come into the new ideology of there's no such thing as male or female, there's a person. When they're able to move beyond that, there'll be more women in technology, there'll be more women employed in the sciences, there'll be more research papers that are openly published by women. Yes, my slide. Yes, my slideshow will be available. LV2600.com. I'm going to put my slideshow up along with the others from previous conventions that I've done related to the subject, and there is a suggestion link with it for comments, and that will probably be up by Tuesday afternoon, because I'll do it as soon as I get home from the conference. Lehigh Valley. Thank you for that lovely correction. Yes, we are separate, though we share one is dot, we are .com, they are .org. I will shove it over there. You're welcome. There will be a section for downloads, and in there will be the speeches. This one, the previous incarnation of it, and the original beta version that I used as a half an hour sort of fill-in. I also will put the entire bibliography with it. I have a 4-page bibliography of all of my research sources. Anybody? I'm sort of running out of time. Over. Oh, all the way in the back.
Sorry.
Okay.
Just an observation that I've noticed going through several novels. The number of women in a computer science program, in computer science programs, seems to be decreasing over the past 8 years. Significantly, actually.
Yeah. That's the problem.
It's surprising that it still happens.
It's surprising that more of them don't fight back against it and say, no, I'm not leaving. I'm going to stay here.
I've known a number of very, very good female programmers who have been forced out pretty much by matter of grades.
I have a really weird thought on that one, that if that college that you're in forces you out because you're female, they really didn't want you in the first place. Take your intelligence somewhere else and make some other college famous because their female student came up with this magnificent theory that's published everywhere and let the first college sit and suck their thumb about it. Yeah, small-minded places like that, and I don't get along. Okay, I'm just about out of time, but I will be floating around the conference, so if anyone else has comment, question, concern, something, a woman they'd like to suggest, I'll be floating around. You can't miss me, trust me. Thank you.